Okay, so it looks that we are ready to start. So my name is Ville Mustonen. I work at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and have been a long time, a long-term participant of this workshop. So I would like to thank Michael Lessig and Paul Snikowski, the organizers who are present at the moment. Thank you for organizing this and thank you for having me here. And today I talk about quantifying selection from time series data, and this is analysis of one particular experiment, but put this in a little bit wider context. So if you look at the fitness effects of mutations, they can range from highly deleterious, near neutral, and then highly beneficial. And within this workshop, we have seen several talks which essentially try to quantify what it means to the mutation and its fixation probability to have some fitness advantage. And it turns out to be a very complicated question because it's not only decided by the fitness effect of that particular mutation, but everyone else in the population as well. So then you would have clonal interference, for instance. So there are several nice talks to be watched again in the internet now. And what this means roughly for the evolutionary dynamics is that when you have weaker effects, you tend to have more stochasticity in the evolution dynamics, and when you have stronger effects, then things become gradually more deterministic. And we can try to measure these fitness effects by observation of just doing sequencing of populations and multiple species, and then using population genetic theory and do inferences on that data under some assumptions. And this is one standard way to quantify fitness effects. And it's quite the opposite then with experiments in the sense that we can also do experimental evolution, but quite often this is my understanding that because of the time scales that are involved, we are probing the extremely strong effects. And I'm actually talking today about these very strong effects. So experiment that is running only tens of generations, and yet you see movement of allele frequencies. So it's going to be a wide range of things that one can study here. And with these experimental sets, it looks to me that you are limited to these very strong effects, and you have to do inference if you want to look at the modest effects. And the modest effects could be, for instance, a selection coefficient of 10 to the minus 5. So probably something that you can't detect in the lab. But it would make a big difference for Drosophila if it has a population size of 10 to the 6 or larger. So it would really affect the fixation probability of that allele drastically. So I start with acknowledgement part one. So this is the data set that I will be studying, and it's a yeast data set. I described that a little bit in more detail. And Leopold Parts was a graduate student of Richard Durbin, and Leo and Gianni. Gianni is a yeast PI in Nottingham. They are part of this quantitative selection inference from this data that I talk today. But I would like to thank all of the authors for doing these experiments. And let's have first overview of the experiment. So the basic setup is that you have two parental strains of yeast. You have a West African strain and North American strain. You cross them for 12 generations, and via this crossing you generate a large pool of segregants. And what you do then, you have this large pool of segregants, you put them under some condition. And the condition in this experiment is heat stress. So you expose the population to 40 degrees of Celsius heat stress, and then you just see what happens in the time course of a few days. And you sequence the DNA of the pool, So you don't go for individual isolates, but you sequence the DNA of the pool. And for us, this means, if we think about how to infer selection from this kind of data, is that we don't know the linkage information. So we just have the marginal frequencies. And let's see what we can do with them. And it's a fantastically cool protocol in a sense. They can do it for both haploid and diploid in haploid and diploid modes. And I talk about the haploid version of the experiment today. And it means that after the initial rounds of crossing, you start the selection. There's no recombination during the selection. So again, one complication removed. So,
sorry. What is the order of magnitude of the number of generation for selection? Is it?
I'm going to list some of these parameters here. So what kind of evolutionary forces should we consider when we analyze such data? So first of all, the population size in the pool is something like between 10 to the 7. So it's 10 million to 100 million yeasts. So it's a very, very large pool. And the protocol is such that you replate every 48 hours, and you take 10% of the cells for the next plate, and you use the 90% to sequence. And the duration of the experiment is 3 times 96 hours. And I don't know how to convert that number to generations precisely, but my understanding is that it's safe to say that it's less than 100 generations. And from these numbers, we can actually already start to think what would be the role of genetic drift in this experiment. And because genetic drift operates at the timescales that are proportional to the population size, we can see that there is at least 5 orders of magnitude difference between those timescales. So I think it's safe to assume that drift plays no role. And I already mentioned there's no recombination during this. During this selection experiment.
Were they grown on plates, propagated on plates, or in liquid?
I think in plates. So it's replating.
If it's on plate, go ahead.
No, just a bit of clarification. Really?
So they are sex and then selected during the asexual phase on plates.
Okay, so I will clarify this.
Okay.
So I have the information here. That's good. I will clarify that. So I'm not going to commit yet fully to that answer.
I look forward to the clarification because it you know, issues about whether they're well mixed and during the competitions and so forth. So that's going to be important.
Yes. Okay. So one other question is here, what's the role of beneficial de novo mutations? And again, you can do a back of an envelope calculation where you say that let's do the worst case scenario, where at the beginning of the experiment you start with 1 over n, which n is now the population size, and you start growing deterministically. And you ask the question, how strong the selection should be that you would observe that at the end of the experiment. And you get a number that it should be 5 to 10% per generation. And I basically think that such large effects are extremely rare. And we probably wouldn't see any of them yet in this kind of a time interval. Because you would need to, and our detection threshold is about 1 over 100. So that's the read depth of the sequencing.
So I'm sorry. So what you're saying is, suppose you have a new mutation at the beginning of the experiment.
Exactly when you start.
The frequency is 1 over n.
Yeah. And then you just see what happens if it goes true. So essentially, based on these considerations, I think both drift and de novo mutation can be assumed to play negligible roles. And what is more, because of the setting of the experiment, that it's crossing experiment, you start with the finite frequency with these alleles, which is close to 0.5. It looks that deterministic equations of motion would be appropriate for looking at this. So let's look at the data. So I'm going to, X is just denoting the West African allele frequency. And here is chromosome 2, which is the first one that we focus now. And this W1 means that this data is now in the rawest form. So it's the window size. I occasionally have window when I have done a sliding window just to highlight something. So then there would be W10 or something like that. It's a moving average. But now this is the raw data. And this is at time point zero, at the beginning of the experiment. And what you see here is about 2,000 segregating sites. And if you look at the just the distances between those sites, this is the histogram that you get. So it has a mean and median. So mean is something like 300, and median is a little bit less than 200 base pairs. And let's see what happens when the selection.
Is the bulk of this exponential roughly, or like?
I haven't checked. It looks like.
Looks like
maybe it has.
Just a bit more tail, right?
It has probably a little bit. I haven't plotted this in a log scale, so I don't know if it's if it has. It looks like by eye that it has too many. It's basically a statement about the recombination rates in the. During the initial.
Some depleted regions.
Yeah. And some hotspots, probably.
Can I briefly ask, so how many chromosomes does yeast have? And
I think it's 16.
Oh, okay. And you have like this number of segregating sites?
About 30,000 for the whole set. And this is just one chromosome.
Okay.
So let's just look what happens.
Sorry, on the previous plot, what is the y-axis actually? On the red one.
The y-axis is the allele frequency of the West African allele. So you have crosses between North American and West African alleles. So then you have a segregating site, and then you start counting. You have sequenced the population. You count how many times you see the West African allele. And that is the fraction.
And in the West African population is fixed, right? The allele in the population?
No, it's a crossing experiment.
And then what is the X? The X is the length of the chromosome, or no?
Yeah.
It's a cord along the chromosome.
Yeah, it's locus. It goes from, thank you for asking this, because these plots are kind of the essence of the talk. So it's good that you get the axis right now immediately. So it goes from zero to about 1 million.
That's coordinates of the segregating sites.
Yes, but it's chromosome. Yes, exactly. Those are the coordinates along the chromosome where these sites are segregating. And then I just showed you the differences between those coordinates. What's the previous plot?
And the source of the vertical uncertainty in the frequencies is just you're sequencing a whole population, and that's some variance.
Yes. So. There are essentially, if you do this crossing, you would expect it to be at 0.5. So you can see that there's probably, and there has been some selection during this crossing protocol. And the guys who did this experiment have analyzed that stuff. But it is still quite close to 0.5. And the noise that you see here, because this is the raw scale, we have a binomial sampling process in some sense, because we do this sequencing, which has a mean depth of 100 in this initial pool. So that's that kind of sets you this noise. But this noise is coming from the initial. This is time zero.
The points have a sort of varying density on this, right?
They have, because there's
X is a single polymorphism.
Yes. Yes.
And then the next one is maybe 50 base pairs later. And
well, what I showed you, the distribution. Right, I have given you the distribution of this. But that's kind of known because there are recombination cold spots in some regions, and then you wouldn't have this crossing. And also, there are some parts are more accessible to sequencing. So,
but does this graph tell us already this, that there's a lot of LD, or are you coming to?
Well, I don't know. I'm just at the moment. I would put all that aside and let's wait. Let's see what the data tells
us. I'm just sort of just thinking like the axis on a scale of a few thousand base pairs looks similar mm-hmm. to each other, more similar than the ones that are 100,000 base pairs away from each other. So is that? You're going to come to this.
I think this is good. So I'm very, because this is a data that we are presently analyzing. I'm very excited to hear how different people see this. So you already would feel that there is some linkage here, and I think you're right. Let's see. Let's continue, Wolfram.
Can you say for clarification how that plot would look in the West African population before the crossing experiment?
I think they are fixed sites, if I understand. So it's they're segregating.
Just a solid line at one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I didn't understand the question. Yes, so this is the allele frequency. So it means that West African is at 0.6, and it means that this allele, the North American one, is at 0.4.
And the West African strain started with, it's monoclonal? Okay.
And this also means that the two strains do not share any allele? Do not have any allele in common?
Those just aren't included in here. If they're shared,
they are not totally shared. They're left out.
Okay, so this is time point after, time point one is the green line now. So with red is zero, green is time point one after 96 hours. Then we run it again for another 96 hours, that's blue. And then we run it again for another 96 hours, and that's black. And I'm just going to do now the coarse graining, so you can see. So I do a sliding window of 5 here, and this is how it looks. And let's try to understand this quantitatively. And for that, we need some kind of a framework. And this is how we have gone about it. So let's investigate some selective scenarios for that. So we write trajectory probabilities under some evolutionary model for this data. So we have some model here, and then we have, these are the counts. How many times in the sequencing you saw that allele at position I? And then this is binomial sampling probability, and this Ni of t is the actual read depth. And that's very nice because we have that information. That information is actually not only varying across loci, but it also depends on the time, because you might have a different yield from a sequencing experiment. And what we did as a check in the beginning is that we inferred this N, just one mean N for the whole data set from the fluctuations, and we got the mean right. So, but this is of course much nicer if you have that information, and that's the nature of the data, that you have it. So you kind of know that sampling process, what's going on.
So I refers to the particular segregating site?
Yes. And so then generally we would infer model parameters for maximum likelihood. And this is just some model matrix, some things that we have done and some things we haven't done yet. So neutral would be the first one to consider. Initial linkage. For the neutral case, if you do deterministic theory, it doesn't really matter, because if you have a neutral case and drift plays no role, everything stays the same. So selection is zero. Then we have independent drivers, would mean that we assume no linkage. Selection is additive. Then we have driver plus passengers. So passenger is now essentially a neutral locus, so there's no selection, but there is linkage to the driver. Then we have interacting drivers, and the interaction between the drivers could either be realized with epistasis or linkage. So, but if I plug linkage to be zero, I can have that interaction via epistasis. And then we can have interacting drivers plus passengers. So linkage gets gradually more complex. And then I haven't even named this, what would be this, but we could have linkage, time, and or frequency dependent selection. And that's the last box is beyond the scope of this talk, and I also think that it's beyond the resolution of the data. So it's just probably not doable with that kind of
But in reality, presumably all these things are going on. It would be surprising if they weren't all.
I don't know. Absolutely don't know. So I'm basically, I think it's in some sense a benefit that I know so little about yeast. So I'm not going to, I'm open-minded. Let's see what happens. So
maybe the question is not, is like, what's the minimal model that can explain this data?
Yes, right. yes. That's exactly how we think about that. So there are probably other minimal models. Maybe you don't parameterize your model in the correct way. So there could be some other stuff going on. But anyway, so this is how it would look if it's neutral. And so this is a little bit clumsy simulated example of neutral evolution. But I these slides probably are viewed also without the talk. So I want to be clear that this is not the data now. So x dot equals zero. So you have some true frequency, and it stays constant. And I have now done the binomial sampling. And 100, you stay closer to the line. And N20, you have a little bit more noise on the system.
And can I ask a question about the? So when you do the sequencing, there is no. You don't sequence individual genomes, right?
No, this is pooled DNA. And the key assumption that goes in there is that every read comes from different individual. And given the depth of sequencing, I think that's fair in this case.
Yeah, so that's why you can have a different, that's why sort of the binomial sampling is independent for each locus.
Yeah. There is the reads are quite short, and sometimes I guess you would also be able to see two sides in the same read, right? But not in general. But I have just done that completely independently to sampling because I know the read depth for this alleles.
Yes, and so the read length is so short that normally you assume that each read length has only.
Well, I don't even, I think there's probably could be some more information there, but that's not what I've done. So we have now all the, they are all considered independent.
Yes. So if I understand correctly, that means that if you see any linkage or any, if you see linkage, it's because of read linkage and not because of your, the sampling bias is the same.
Yes. So that makes sense. So we haven't, I haven't done any coarse graining in this direction, in this local direction. And it's when I show you plots where this W is 10 or whatever, the window, it's all done after the inference was done. So the inference is always done at the raw counts. And so in some sense you are saying that you could basically impose some linkage by that sampling if you infer that there. So if I understand you correctly, and yeah, so we haven't done that. So they are really independent in that sense, but okay. So maybe we go forward.
So these dots is now, so they refer to sort of time zero or here there is no movement.
This is a simulated example of neutral evolution. So there's x dot, which is zero. The true frequency is 0.4. It stays straight line, but I've sampled that in 4 points with different depth.
Yeah.
100. And 20.
If it's pure sampling, no dynamics. X dot equals zero.
X dot equals zero. But that's how it would look. Two instances of that process, how they would look. And this is how the log likelihood looks. Neutral interpretation. And you can see that it stays constant almost all the way. And then there's this dramatic drop. And that dramatic drop, of course, corresponds to the event. And now I have all the four time points in the same plot. Red is again time 0, green time 1, blue time 0.2, and black time 0.3. And the thick lines are the data, and the thin lines, which are all the same because x dot is 0, are the inferred value under this model. And you can see that it does, of course, quite poorly. So it would say that the true population frequency is here in all during the whole duration of the experiment. But of course, this is just poor. So it's not explaining this. This is not fluctuations, what we saw, kind of, if that's that's the thing.
Do you have data on all chromosomes, even though you're not just showing chromosome 2?
Okay. I just want to be... We'll get to that. Just want to really scrutinize one event first. And let's make a little bit more complicated model. So additive unlinked drivers. So we still assume that there's no linkage. So that if I see a segregating site with some West African allele and some North American alleles, next one is going to be the independent background. And now we allow a fitness difference between the alleles. So sigma is the fitness difference. It's further assumed that there's no epistasis at this point. Then we can solve for deterministic time evolution. And now the x dot equals sigma times x times 1 minus x, and extract maximum likelihood estimates of selection. And here we have a simulated example of a driver. So this is the logistic curve we have seen many times during this workshop. And again, just to as an example of the noise or the sampling. And
what do the colors mean, sorry, in your allele variance? The red and the blue. Sorry.
It's a illustration. Let's call the blue one West African, okay?
Blue and is West African.
And red is North American.
Okay.
Or the other way around.
For the sake of illustration.
Yes, it's the sake of illustration. And so this is now how the log likelihood looks. So you can see that we have dramatically improved the log likelihood at the position where the event happened. Okay?
So you allow for independent sigmas?
Yes. Exactly. So that's the additive drivers, additive unlinked drivers.
And so you get also in your maximum likelihood a selection profile.
I will show that very shortly. Let's look at first the fit.
I mean, also you have now in principle 2,000 more parameters. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
One of them is gigantic, or at least in the middle.
Let's see. There's a consistent framework for dealing with that. So now. You can see that the thin lines are now separating. So they are not anymore falling to the same place as in the neutral evolution. And the thin red line, thin green line, and the black and blue lines are doing very well here. And this looks already, I hope it's visible, this looks already that maybe we are done. But then, look at this. So here, red, green, they're completely missing the real action, the data. And that's, of course, quite easy to see if you think about the model. So the model is this logistic equation And if you have frequencies that are at about 0.5, you are moving at about constant velocity. And that's what you see. That's what's allowed for that kind of a model. Whereas the data does something like this. You are here, chomp, you stop. So let's get back to that shortly, but I just first show you the selection profile. This is how it looks. Units of selection are per 96 hours during the talk. There's one plot that I actually divided that out, and I point that out later. And this is the inferred selection profile.
So hang on here, you said there is a framework. I mean, if you have 2,000 more parameters, as you mentioned, obviously it will look like you have to do become much, much better. Right? And so how do you deal with that when you accept the model? I mean, there's a framework.
There's a framework. You need to just see how much log likelihood improves per increased parameter. So when you increase a parameter, you add a parameter, it must impose a cost. So you have like model selection criteria.
So then in the end, you would have a most loci, you would say it's zero?
Well, I would, this is of course zero, right? This is just neutral, right? Or just our sampling. Mm-hmm. This is just inferred sigmas of the drivers. It's basically, let's continue. We are going to get rid of many of these things.
I mean, there's something very interesting here, because you see a selection profile, right?
That yes. Obviously, yes, yes, yes.
And the question would be, how would you interpret this red curve, right? Is this selection at a single locus, or do we really have a selection?
I think...
Like, naively, it looks as is here, okay, you use a 50 of these 2,000 variables to actually substitute selection for a linkage or something. Right? Yes. Because this is perfectly compatible with a single site being under strong selection.
How do you know that?
This is the unbiased inference.
Yes. So
so you comment on that later, probably.
Yes. 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 Boris.
But just so I understand your earlier point where you said, this is sort of good, but there's this one aspect of the data where it jumps and it sticks. Is that you're coming to it probably, but could that be frequency dependent selection happening at a particular locus or set of loci?
I would say that we haven't gone that far. I think we have much simpler way of getting that done.
That could be an issue, that there could be frequency-dependent selection of some loci.
Absolutely. Like I said, there are many things. You could have time-dependent selection, you could have frequency-dependent selection, all that kind of things. And we just look at the data, we build up complexity, and let's see how well we do. Boris.
So speaking of complexity, I guess going back to Michael's remark, the question is, can you fit it with a much simpler model?
Yes.
Where you sort of decorrelate your selection and just put in some plausible correlation length of linkage.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's correct. So let's see if we now drop the assumption that they're unlinked. So we allow for linkage between the alleles. And for the sake of argument, let's call the highest inferred unlinked sigma as the driver. And we suppose that all other loci carry passenger mutations. Now we solve the time evolution for this linked system, and we can extract maximum likelihood estimates. And this is an important point for the unknown initial linkage from the time series, because this is we have only the marginals for this set. So we don't have the haplotype frequencies. And just let's recall what would be the expectation, how it probably could look. So if here is the linkage disequilibrium between the passenger and the driver lives at locus zero. If during the crossing there was a uniform recombination rate, you would probably have exponential decay of linkage. And if we look at the dynamics now, if everyone starts at 0.5 at time point zero, including the driver, this is how the evolution would look. So these are just different times in evolution, and then you would fix. So we would have something like that. And let's see.
You say initial linkage is unknown.
Yes.
But don't we know from the experiments how many crosses we did?
Yes, 12 generations of crossing. But I don't. What I mean is that I don't have genotypes of the initial pool.
That's right.
I have
information which you could use.
Yes, but what about if I say that I don't want to use that? I just want to look at the data. Okay. So this is back to the selection profile, and this is now the driver, and let's see if we use that. This is the inferred DIJ, what you get from the maximum likelihood procedure. And you can see that to this direction it looks nice. This is very excited to get this plot. It looks basically what you assume. This direction it also looks okay, but this is non-monotonic. I don't know why that is. Maybe there was non-trivial things going on in the initial pool. So don't know about that, but the overall shape I think it's okay. And
can I ask you, isn't this, I mean, this has to be that way just because of this discrepancy between the thin lines and the thick lines in your previous plot? Isn't that what you would expect when you do this?
I don't know. So how do you mean?
Well, remember you said that because of the logistic, you expect that...
There's no logistic now. It's a different function. The logistic is now only doing the time evolution of this guy. It's a different family of curves now. This
but in the previous one, you had the logistic and you made this argument that you you would expect everything to be in a constant velocity, but then
yes,
you don't seem to constant velocity.
Yes.
So
yes.
Given that, if you now do this, wouldn't you expect exactly this, that there is that on the...
I would hope for it. I don't probably expect before I do it. So in a sense that I thought that the constant velocity thing, that was a kind of a smoking gun, but at what point you know that smoking gun is...
I'm just saying, man, I mean...
No, I don't know.
You didn't say you were surprised, but I mean,
given
that previous data, this is not surprising.
Well, that's good. I can agree with that. Probably I used the word we were excited to see that. I don't know if we were surprised, but this essentially looks very nice.
That lump is in the same place as the problem in the previous slide.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's kind of within the noise, right? I mean, you see like that is roughly...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's like that. But, okay, so this is not a prediction then. So you can see that here, visually it looks that it's doing worse. I don't know how much we should read into that. Let's look at the log likelihood soon. But here, the problem that we had has completely disappeared. So that part is now explained.
So that's
explained by this bomb.
Yeah, probably. Sorry?
In this model, you have only selection on one side.
Yes.
Right? So
yeah.
You went from one extreme where everything
yes.
has a selection coefficient.
But there's an important point, and let's get to that, which is that so this is just to show how it was previously. They did this constant speed traveling. Now it's hitchhiking, it's doing that. So I hope it's visible.
So in some sense, maybe one could ask the same question as for the selection, right? So how well would you do with an LD model
with few parameters. Right?
Yes.
So it's just
yes.
sort of a,
yes.
a monotonic decrease.
Yes, yes. So
and the rest is...
Let's come back to that. So just to be very clear, what you said is correct, but remember, because we don't know the initial linkage, we still have exactly the same model complexity. Now we have just replaced the selection by the initial linkage which we infer. But let's talk about the model complexity shortly. The orange line is now driver and passengers, and they have the same model complexity. And you can see that the part where it previously failed is now doing well. But importantly, it looks that it's doing also here equally well. Even for I, it looked that the green thin line was out, but it probably gets better at the very end. So it's very hard to do that by I, looking at the. So this is the more rational way of looking at that data.
The best difference is about 2 log likelihoods, which isn't enough to justify an extra parameter.
No, they have the same degrees. They're identical. They have the same number of freedom. You are right. Yeah, absolutely. But they have the same degrees of freedom. And also, I have to put the following caveat here. So you can see this is the coarse graining window is 12. So there might be individual loci that it is doing much better job or something like that, and those would need to be then followed up. So in some individual cases, you might still have a big difference, and you want to call it. But this is just to give you the shape of the data. Okay, so what about if we postulate the homogeneous recombination rate across the region during the initial crossing and try to parameterize linkage effect with this rate? And essentially, now we replace all these linkage parameters with just the sum rate, one rate. And this is now how it looks. Purple line is that, and this row, this recombination rate, is not yet the maximum likelihood estimate. So I tried a couple of values, and this is a fit by eye. So this is going to improve. But let's see with this fit by eye, what can it do? And the rate would be 2 times 10 to the minus 5 during the initial crossing. So that's the interpretation. And this is how it does. And well, you can see this guy is still there, but this works perfectly also with that. So there's some deviations, and if we go to
is 2 times 10 to the minus 5 per base pair over 12 generations?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a very reasonable number for what you would. It's like one crossover chromosome per generation.
I think so. Yeah.
So that's what you would guess from the biology.
Yeah, and I think that's going to change a little bit, but not probably a lot. So when I really do the inference of that, and this is how it looks. Purple line is now the model with one rate and one sigma, and you can see that. Julia, like you said, I think there's just overall no doubt that this is superior, because we have so many we have lost so many parameters for the purple line. But I also have to say that this is, again, there might be individual loci that there's still something more to be discovered. And let's just I think now it's essentially we have gone through that sweep. So let's look at different things now. And
so before we move on, can you come back to the experimental protocol? I would guess that your experimental colleagues were letting these yeast grow up under well-mixed conditions.
Yes.
In a liquid culture, and then plating them out occasionally to make the analysis. Is that right?
Let me see.
You want them to be well mixed, and if you want the population size to be as gigantic as you claim, I presume that's what happened.
Yeah, and resuspended in distilled water. So I think I have to check that. So I think it's a well-mixed population. So that's the aim of the experiment for this.
I mean, just as a comment, I mean, this is wonderful data and certainly a sensible thing to analyze it in this way. But when things are growing up, even in a well-mixed liquid culture, yeast sometimes tend to evolve towards clumping. They stick together. And the various reasons why they might want to do that, to share resources and things like that. And then, you know, your well-mixed assumption begins to break down because then you have clumps moving through the well-stirred.
Well, look, they actually interrogated and did genotyping of the final population for some loci, and there's no evidence of that.
So clumping.
It's not something that they would find a clonal population. So they would find numerous haplotypes in the final pool. Is that something that?
Well, it depends on the size of the clumps, and maybe it doesn't matter.
Okay, so that's something I will clarify, but I just don't know at all. Okay.
But for this experiment, the actual population size doesn't matter so much, right? As long as it's
gigantic.
Well, I would guess that even if it's like 1,000 or 10,000, it should still be okay.
I think it's good that it's large for several reasons. Because then you have really the variance present. So I think, like, for if instance, what I'm going to say next would not work if you have only 10,000. So I think okay, so we have now analyzed this one sweep in detail, and let's just look at the global stuff for a while.
It's one more question. So I wonder whether people have got out the sort of all the information on this, whether this linkage model, the way it's treated, is already getting out most of this. I mean, in the sense that you're looking at a single event.
Yes.
You have relatively few linkage blocks, right? Because you don't have so many recombinations. So there's stochasticity in the blocks as well. Are you sampling from the length of link blocks as well?
I am not actually. This is really just one rate and exponential. You right. Get what I'm showing.
So this is kind of probably a field treatment that. And I would guess that could one do a sampling just as you do for this frequencies and.
I will make a note of that. That's a very very cool point. And I have to also add that Leo Parts, who's done the sequence, the allele calls from the sequencing experiment, he has some cool ideas how to try to use the reads to somehow get an estimate of the local recombination. But that's not done yet, so it's something that he's thinking of that kind of stuff. And then, of course, we would have a fine scale image of that. And so let's just like look.
I have just a question. Do you know what's the gene that's below your
biological?
Yes
and no. Of course, these guys who did the experiment have reported that, have done stuff. For this talk and for this purpose, I don't even know if they are on genes or in the genetics or whatever. So I absolutely don't want to know. So I just look at the dynamics. You should follow then later these. What you think is a driver and do bioinformatics on that, do functional experiments. And so, but I don't have any of that information with me.
Why don't you want to know?
I want to know it later. Of course, I want to follow it later, but not now.
I think because you want to be unbiased.
Well.
But you didn't say that it's ongoing work, I think.
Okay, well, you know, that's what I mean.
I know the answer.
Of course. So, anyway.
Going to fixation so fast.
Yes, of course.
Please,
yes.
Somebody.
And what you're showing, can you say already that this mutation must be?
I can't say that. So epistasis will come if we get ever to that point. So look, let's just do some bold assumptions now. So let's compare the additive. Let's go for the whole genome. So that was chromosome 2 that we looked. So compare the additive unlinked tribal log likelihoods to the neutral log likelihood. Let's take the difference of those two, sort that those differences, and I'm just plotting now the 800 biggest differences. And this is the locus coordinate, and now the chromosomes are stacked here, the y-axis. And you can see, this is the guy that we talked about now for almost 1 hour. So this is that event. And let's just pick the strongest right, unlinked selection.
Can you explain again what is shown there? Yeah, what are the red dots mean?
So that's the difference between the log likelihoods of additive unlinked traverse versus neutral. So basically, we just look for big events, and we take the 800 biggest differences across the genome, and these are the plots. So that's kind of a gives you two.
Each chromosome is like.
It's one line here.
Right.
And this is the one that we discussed now for so you can see it's about 590,000.
So the positions of a family of 16 curves.
And
now for chromosome 2, you have basically two regions where you have a selection.
Yeah.
Where you have a drive.
Yeah.
But do you just conclude that there?
No, I just said that for that sweep, it looks that that's and that was still additive stuff. And if you think that it's additive, and you saw how the the linkage decay goes, this would be unlinked with that.
Right, but I just wonder, didn't you now? You said you talked about it for an hour, and you basically concluded that the left group of dots for chromosome 2.
Yeah, but look, we looked at this window. This window was
But we only looked at that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, no, I just wondered because I think that was kind of the how it looks, and I think that's kind of has been helpful for us to look that in very great detail. And anyway, so.
Sorry. Did you expect that all the points, all the dots, should be all together? And so when you have dots that are on their own, what does it mean?
I don't know.
Well, you saw that these dips have a certain width, and I think this is reflected in this plot as well, right? So they group together, and this is probably
so
the width of the sweep.
Yeah, truly, I think basically this is very coarse-grained. I just want to have now a global view, and I want to do it in 10 minutes. And we talked about this guy a lot, and I think that was fun. I really enjoyed that. Analysis, not this discussion really, that much, yeah, I think it's good, but if you want to have a global view, let's.
I have a global question. Why is the reason why 90% of the sweeps are on the left-hand side?
They are different lengths.
It has to show the length of the chromosomes. Okay. It would be nice to show the length of the chromosome in the future.
Point taken. This is the first talk of this data, so I...
You're one friend. And I've seen that.
Okay, so this is selection coefficients, right, of the drivers. And this is the one that we discussed, right? So there's even one stronger. And now minus means that if they're negative, it means that the North American allele is the winner. If they're positive, it means that the West African one is the winner. And if we now further assume that these driver regions are unlinked, now we actually can do sampling of the genotypes, right? We can just go and we can draw the allele with the appropriate probability. And we can then ask what would be the under additive assumption of unlinked drivers, what would be the haplotype fitness distribution? And this is what is shown here. And I have subtracted out the mean fitness at the initial pool. So this red distribution has a mean fitness of 0. And this is the plot where I have actually expressed the fitness in the units of hours. So I also took the 96 hours away. And this is how you can see how it moves. So you have this variation in the beginning. Then you have green, blue, and black. And we can also do similar kind of plots for degree of adaptation. And this is just a different way of showing the same thing. So the mean fitness, by definition, starts at zero, and it increases during the experiment. And we can do degree of adaptation, which is basically checking how far is the population from the optimal when compared to a random sequence. And quite ironically, you can see that the initial condition is less good than random, little bit, and then it improves under this interpretation, which is the additive drivers which are unlinked. It improves and goes to 0.7. So it looks that if you would run the experiment longer, and if this additive interpretation, if that's correct, then you would still improve a little bit. What's the question?
If you take these numbers for the mean fitness, should the change in mean fitness have been big enough to make any difference on the allele trajectories? No. Probably not, because they're all linked, right? Yeah, never mind. No, that's cool.
And
this is, is it significant that the initial condition is like?
I don't know.
Maybe this could be have to do with the sort of linkage versus selection issue.
I think it just has to do what were the selection pressures in the initial, in the crossing, and if there's any bias there, and the bias in this heat experiment is in a different direction, then you need to go back from there. So I'm not making a lot of thing. I think this is interesting. It goes to 0.7. So, Lilia.
This is the distance from the peak, but the peak would be one where all these mutations are fixed. You don't know if it's really the peak.
Right.
That could be mutations that yet improve this.
Optimal is myelodependent here.
I'm very clear about that. So this is assuming drivers, and this is actually these are the points, and I'm not even getting them the same status of data points, because this is now filtered through our interpretation. But that's correct. And you know, if there's epistasis, it could already be at its local optimum, right? So it's really this is how it would look. And what I really would like to do is I would like to see how much of the fitness variance we could explain with these plots, because these are predictions, right? So if we can access something of this kind, we could see how much more there is to be explained. So that's basically something that I would really want us to know. So that would be very nice. And similarly, you can see that the fitness flux is bigger in the beginning, and then it gradually declines under this interpretation, and the global total fitness flux grows. And now, so how much time do I have? 10 minutes. Okay, so maybe that's okay. So so this was global view under additive drivers model, but of course we don't know if there's epistasis or something like that in the population. And there is, at least from the modeling point of view, you can go beyond the unlinked additive drivers, and so you can solve the deterministic evolution of a multi-driver system. But this is actually not that not that helpful at the moment, and this is something that I would really like to know if someone has worked a lot with multi-locus deterministic evolution models, because the problem for us here is that while we can do it for the haplotypes, we don't have the haplotype frequencies, and it means essentially that we don't know the initial condition. And then you can try to get your way around that. And what we have tried so far is that we work on the assumption that we would know the pairwise linkages accurately. not the full haplotypes, but we would know the pairwise frequencies. And then we have tried to write the equations of motion for the multi-trimer system, where we keep updating those linkages. But it works for two drivers plus any number of passengers, but it doesn't, it's an approximation, and it works in short times, but it doesn't really do the job, so to say. So if someone knows a good way of basically approximating the multilogous evolution, given that you don't know the initial condition. Boris?
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, okay, good, thanks.
Why not just sequence the initial population?
Well, I think that's the next thing to do. So I have thought about what is the next experiment, like, do you want to sequence more time points? Do you want to wait longer and do? But I think for it, somehow it's becoming clear that the initial linkage would be really helpful here. And yeah, so would be nice to hear comments who do experiments. People, do you think? I think that would be probably from the modeling point of view the most informative one for us to get a little bit more resolution on that. And yeah, so this is just a standard model, two locus, two alleles model, and you can then do things with that. And here's just one example of an epistatic interaction between two drivers. And there's a great review, Perspective Sign Epistasis, by Dan Weinreich et al. And you should also look at a talk given by Joachim Krug. So essentially, here you see that depending on the other allele, the fitness effect of going from 1 to 0 will change. So, and this landscape you can always parameterize with three parameters. So you can write it so that you fix, because only fitness differences matter. So you can fix one of these corners to be 0. Then you have first lobe is given by sigma x, the other one sigma y, and then the last one is sigma y plus sigma x plus some xi. And if xi is 0, it's additive landscape. But if xi is something else, then you have any combination of these guys. And so this is essentially what's the status here. So it's now clear to us that we can't infer epistasis unless we know the initial linkage or unless we fix it somehow. So it just comes, we have absolutely no statistical power to detect that, because the competing model would be that they are linked but an additive. So that's what we can do. And there are two ways around this. And one of them is either assuming that the drivers are unlinked, for instance. And it could be a fair assumption, but also like just doing the getting information about the initial frequencies. And this is something that I think is also interesting, because our statistical power increases very greatly if we would assume that the landscapes are confined in some way, that we would be looking for instance, that these are mixed combinations. So you have here both of these alleles are West African, and here both are North American, but the mixed ones would be down. And we could parameterize this with one parameter, right? Just the depth of this going down. And if we have that kind of, so it's basically putting a prior on these landscapes. But for that, you need biological insight, and I don't really know what to expect. I think this might be.
These are cartoon landscapes,
yeah,
from the Weinreich Review article or something. Like, well, them or something.
Yeah, we have done them ourselves, but okay. But I think like anyone who's interested about this kind of stuff, this talk is good to see, and this article is like the starting point for that.
But it would be a miracle if they were actually threefold degenerate. In all detail, it's just a simplification to assume that?
Yes, and why we have something like that is that this kind of landscape will give you a fixed state which has a polymorphic site. It stays polymorphic.
I see.
And we have some
simple way to get that. Okay.
Yeah, so we have some intuition for that. And actually, within the resolution that we have, we wouldn't care if these guys are a little bit wiggling, right? Right. So we would be just getting this one very fast thing,
yeah.
And then you have something there. So,
for the initial linkage, I mean, most of your drivers look like they were pretty far apart on the chromosome.
Yeah.
So at any linkage that you start with should be tiny. You aren't running for very long, so.
I don't know, because, you know, we don't really know what went on in the initial crossing. There could be selection there, right? So I basically just saying that I think it's a fair assumption, and that's why I gave you the global view, but it's still an assumption. So the initial pool, we should really go and look at the initial pool. Okay, so anyway, so this is one example, and these are the data points. So Dij, I have fixed that to 0, and chromosome 4, chromosome 14, and this is the kind of analysis we don't know yet what this means. So this is pairwise epistasis only. There could be higher orders epistasis, but this is now triver-triver additive unlinked fit for this data. And this is how the two locus, two alleles genotypes look, and that's the landscape. You can see it's additive landscape. Now there's this, just to guide your eye, there's a plane that is there. And this is now if you add one more degree of freedom. So if you now add this psi parameter to the landscape, this is how it looks. So you can see there's a difference here. And the difference in the log likelihood is 3.6. So, you know, we would need to go and look further what to do. But anyway, so this is something, it's ongoing work, and we want to go to this kind of a picture. So we want to have the full yeast, and we want to use this data to rank interactions that should be tested then.
Can you explain a bit what it means?
Yeah, so these are chromosomes. Here you have the allele frequencies. You have only two time points at this. You have the initial time point and the final one. Because here we try to do something else. It turns out that if you assume that the system is at equilibrium in the end, you don't have to know the linkage between the epistatic things. So you can make also predictions with a little bit different logic. But we have to revisit this stuff. I just want to show this is where we want to go. We want to be able to rank candidate interactions based on these correlations in this time series data. And these are just our variables, what we use for the call, if we call one of these interactions. And
so the outermost rim is the final, is it at the end of the experiment? Or what is the black box on the outer end?
The yellow is now the black line. So
what's the black line?
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
And then these inner connections between chromosomes that are drawn in the middle, what do they mean?
So that would be something that you now postulate or rank an epistatic interaction.
So epistasis.
Yeah.
Ah.
A candidate.
Candidate epistasis, and they're mostly interchromosomal, but there's one.
Well,
chromosome 4 has.
No. Okay, so I should have erased things a little bit here, because like I said, these things are done with much simple thing.
Yeah.
The simple thing has the advantage over what I discussed today in a sense that if you assume certain landscapes, and if you assume further that the experiment was at equilibrium in the end, then it turns out that there are no free parameters anymore. You get for these landscapes, you get the final, you get the relation between the initial marginals and the final marginals, and that information you can try to exploit to draw this stuff. But yeah, like I said, this is where we want to go.
This beginning, right.
Yeah. Okay, so just to we can try to separate drivers, multiple independent drivers from driver with several linked passengers. And this is very interesting. So if we assume independent drivers, we can make predictions of time evolution, haplotype fitness, degree of adaptation, fitness flux, and those should be now somehow tested. And if you know the initial linkage, then we would be able to get pairwise interactions. we have power to do that. So that's going to be interesting to follow. There are many caveats. So I don't know what happens if you have higher order epistasis. This is, of course, now non-trivial initial linkage patterns. So that would then severe these assumptions unless we check them. And or frequency and time-dependent selection. So there are many complications. I actually don't think that it's easy to find the frequency-dependent selection, because you need to postulate a function, or at least one parameter for that, and then you have fixed the shape of a function. Time-dependent selection, it would be wonderful to do such experiments on a protocol that has some fluctuating environment, and that'd be interesting. So I want to just conclude with acknowledgements part two. Chris Illingworth is here. We work together on this. And Leo Bartz, PhD student, a former PhD student at Richard Durbin, he's been instrumental of getting us involved. He's a very active guy, very, very good guy. Gianni Litti, all these beautiful experiments were done under his leadership, and he's also part of this quantitative understanding of the selection. Stefan Schiffels, Michael Lessig's PhD student, came to visit us to Sanger for 3 months last autumn. And as you can see, we are a small team, so there's no hiding, and he has contributed on thinking about this epistasis part. And I would like to thank Wellcome Trust for funding, and thank you.
Do you have any functional information about these drivers?
About this loci?
Yeah.
They have done experiments, yes. So for instance, the QTL locus with this chromosome 2 driver, they have done experiments on that, and it is a quantitative trait locus for the heat phenotype, like heat resistance. So,
presumably all of the ones are, in some sense.
I don't know.
But I mean, they don't know how it works, so to speak. In, you know, what the physiological mechanism is of that locus.
Yeah, they. So maybe we talk about that later. So this is something I don't know precisely the protocol, but there's a very nice yeast genetics protocol to test some of these QTLs and.
I'm just thinking that's one way of getting out of epistasis, potentially.
Yeah, they have ideas for that, and you have a way of testing that, so that's nice. Like in a lab, you can do the functional experiment.
They've checked which genes some of the loci fall on, so there's some genetic information, so they've submitted a paper on that.
So. Yeah, so that's the paper that I had my second slide.
I'm trying to think about this from the point of view of the organism and what's causing the increases in fitness of alleles. You've shown many loci where selection are acting.
Yeah.
Are they working together in a single genotype across multiple genotypes?
What's
the dynamic of competing genotypes?
Well, if you take this global view and the assumption that they were initially unlinked seriously, what it would mean that in the end, when you have reached the fixation, you would have a haplotype with the right allele at every one of those loci, provided that you had that in the original pool.
Yeah.
And there the numbers come important, because if you have 20 loci, you would have about 10 to the 6 haplotypes. So then it's getting, you know, it's getting a little bit, you still have, in 10 to the 8, you have probably one of them at least,
right,
or some of them.
Yeah.
So, but that's the interpretation, and we are just now looking at the marginals of that.
Okay.
But if you do this in your head and think about haplotypes, that's what it would mean.
Right.
Because you don't have de novo mutation of that kind.
Exactly. It'd be interesting to actually sequence some of the, get some idea of genotype frequencies.
They have, and it's not clonal population in the end.
No,
because there are many haplotypes left.
But you saw it's not even, if this additive interpretation is correct, it would take quite a long time still to get.
That's right, because you've only got 3 times 96 hours, which,
yeah.
And again, I guess we don't have the details of what went on in those, but it's got to, you know, this dynamic stuff going.
Are you using the information, because initially you said there were like two experiments, right? One at 40 degrees and one at 23 degrees.
Yes.
And presumably the initial population was the same.
Exactly.
But the selection was different.
Yes.
Right? So are you using information from both of these experiments?
In this analysis, no. But the control doesn't essentially move.
Nothing moves there.
So it's consistent with the fact that it's sampling with basic noise. But of course, like I've seen, shown this plot, there has been non-trivial stuff going on during the initial crossing, and the authors who did the experiment talk about that in their paper that I have shown you. And that's very interesting. They think that's a byproduct, like as a positive byproduct of the protocol. Mm. So it's very nice. So you also, you kind of get that kind of information from there.
Okay.